and two, into a black state and a white state. It would never have worked because there is no possibility of peaceful coexistence when what you create are confessional states, states that do not understand the delivery and unity of the entire human race and of all matter at the world level. Since its birth, the PLO has always proposed that the only solution was the construction of a secular, democratic Palestinian state that had religious freedom and that would be the home of every Jew, Christian, Muslim, or atheist who wanted to live in and fight for a Palestine that contains all of those characteristics. This idea, which had been discarded after Oslo, gained strength again through the joint work of Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim, a Palestinian citizen and an Israeli citizen. They have declared that the only possibility today is a plurinational state where all its citizens have the same duties and rights, where total religious freedom exists and which is part of all religious fundamentalism, be it Christian, Muslim, or Zionist.
Musulman o sionista.
In the Palestine of the last century, to live is to resist, and the Palestinians are convinced to remain in the land of their birth at any cost. They know that they were there before the first invader arrived, and that they will continue to be in that land after the last one leaves.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Darsi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, as you are with us, we have reached the 61st and 2nd verses of chapter Naml. So let's listen to these verses.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
جعل الأرض قرارا وجعل خلالها أنهارا وجعل لها رواسي وجعل بين البحرين حاجزا أإله مع الله بل أكثرهم لا يعلمون.
Is he not best who made the earth a stable ground and placed within it rivers, and made for it firmly set mountains, and placed between the two seas a barrier? Is there a deity with Allah? No, but most of them do not know.
أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ وَيَجْعَلُكُمْ لَكُمْ خُلَفَاءَ الْأَرْضِ أَإِلَهٌ مَعَ اللَّهِ قَلِيلًا مَا تَذَكَّرُونَ.
Is he not best who responds to the desperate one when he calls upon him and removes evil and makes you inheritors of the earth? Is there a deity with Allah? Little do you remember.
Dear listeners, as you were with us in the previous episodes, we mentioned the verses that the Almighty Allah says, is this God that you associate with Allah is better, or the one who created the heavens and the earth? And now the verse continues, أَمَّنْ جَعَلَ الْأَرْضَ قَرَارًا وَجَعَلَ خِلَالَهَا أَنْهَارًا, or he who made the earth a resting place and made it rivers, وَجَعَلَ لَهَا رَوَاسِيَ وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَ الْبَحْرَيْنِ حَاجِزًا, and he placed firm mountains therein, and he placed between the two seas a barrier. أَإِلَهُمْ مَعَ اللَّهِ, is there any God with Allah? بَلْ أَكْثَرُهُمْ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ, but most of them do not know. Also, the 62nd verse that says, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ, or he who answers the distressed one when he calls on him and removes the distress. So, anyway, this verse, I mean these couple of verses, are actually referring to the merit of the peace and firmness of the earth as a resting place for the human beings in this world, and actually compares the artificial idols of the idolaters with Allah. So it says, أَمَّنْ جَعَلَ الْأَرْضَ قَرَارًا وَجَعَلَ خِلَالَهَا أَنْهَارًا, or he who made the earth a resting place and made in it rivers and placed firm mountains therein and placed between the two seas a barrier. So there are four great bounties mentioned in this verse, three of which are about calmness, the calmness of the earth itself. أَمَّنْ جَعَلَ الْأَرْضَ قَرَارًا. So this calmness of the earth itself is, in the meantime, happening at the very same time that it rotates around itself and around the sun, as well as its travel in the constellation of solar system. Its movement is so monotonous and quiet that its habitants never feel it, as if it is standing really fixed in a point and has not any kind of movement in it. Now, another great bounty is the existence of the mountains. وَجَعَلَ خِلَالَهَا أَنْهَارًا وَجَعَلَ لَهَا رَوَاسِي, and he made in it some rivers and he made firm mountains therein. So, as we said before, these mountains have surrounded the lands of the earth, and their roots have clung to each other, and their roots have clung to each other, and have firmed a strong armor against the inner pressures of the earth. So this is how they control the pressures of the earth. And this armor resists against the different kinds of movements created by flow and ebb, resulted from the gravity of the moon. So it is also a barrier against the great storms that actually disturb the calmness of the earth. This is what we also need to be thankful to the Almighty Allah for. Have we ever paid attention to this?
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
So, dear listeners, in this part of the verse, the Almighty Allah is mentioning His great bounties. He says, أَمَّنْ جَعَلَ الْأَرْضَ قَرَارًا, or he who made the earth a resting place. وَجَعَلَ خِلَالَهَا أَنْهَارًا. He made therein some rivers. وَجَعَلَ لَهَا رَوَاسِي. And he made some mountains, firm mountains in it. So another great bounty of the Lord is the one which is the natural hinder, which is between the two flows of a part of the sweet and salty water of some seas or oceans. And the verse says, وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَ الْبَحْرَيْنِ حَاجِزًا. This hajiz is a kind of obstacle. It stops from one side of the water getting mixed with the other side. So this hinder is unseen. This unseen, inviolable obstruction is not anything but the difference of the density of the sweet water and that of the salt water. And this causes the water of the great rivers that comes into the sea do not mix with its salty water for a considerable length of time. And therefore, the flow and ebb of the sea bring it over a great part of the lands to of the seashore whose farms are ready to be irrigated. And this is how it really happens. We will explain this more in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Amin Rastani.
We were speaking about the different inspirations we can take from Ashura. So one of the things that, inshallah, I want to speak about tonight, or take inspiration from, is how tight-knit the little caravan and community of Imam Hussein was. Now, of course, this caravan, as it was making its way towards Karbala, it was being more and more refined. It wasn't like this from the beginning. There were a lot more people on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussein. Of course, as this caravan was shrinking more and more, lots of them didn't know that this caravan is going to end up in Karbala. And so each had their own reason to be there. I don't want to necessarily say they had bad intentions or malicious ones or ones of personal interest. There might have been some who felt like this is the way to go. But as things went by, as time went by, they felt like, no, this isn't going to be something that's going to succeed. Succeed in the outward sense of the term. Yeah? No. They must have felt that, okay, it doesn't look like this is heading anywhere, so let's just drop off of this, let's call it bandwagon that we've jumped on. But as it was refined more and more, it reaches a point where it's pretty solid. And this little caravan, something is binding them together, the individuals in this caravan, that I want to speak about a little bit tonight as well, as a community who wants to follow the footsteps of the Imam, as followers of the 12th Imam today, right? So we are the community of the 12th Imam, whether we like it or not. And we are on a little journey as well, it's as if. And so are we going to be as tight-knit as the caravan of Imam Hussein or not? So I want to talk about that a little bit. So in the following stages, what we want to talk about is that during the end of times, our scholars point out that the relationship between the individuals of the community are something that actually might lead to the zuhur of the 12th Imam. They play a part at least, or can play a part. This wilayah that we have amongst ourselves is something that I've noticed different scholars are paying a little more attention to and speaking about, because they believe that the relationship between the believers is not just any other relationship that might be discussed in sociology. Some pronounce it sociology. I don't think that's the right way to pronounce it. It's sociology. I actually checked before coming. Okay. So, this is something that our scholars are speaking about, you can say maybe more and more. So what I want to do, inshallah, I'm going to talk about a little bit, give some examples of what our literature says about this togetherness and this jama'ah versus being isolated and on my own or on our own. And then once we go through that literature, we want to, in a very short period of time, dissect what this relationship between the mu'mineen is all about. Is it just like any other social gathering that we have across the globe, or is it a little different? Is it something real, or is it something conventional, as they say? Once we go through that, we want to find what the reason is that this is not just a normal relationship that mu'mineen and believers have amongst themselves. There's something special there. That's what makes it a real relationship, not just a conventional one. And finally, some of the hadiths that we have in regards to how the believers, when they deal with each other, it is a good way of figuring out how much wilaya they have in them. In other words, you can gauge your wilaya of the imam through the wilaya that you have with each other, inshallah. So these are some of the things that we want to talk about tonight, to take inspiration from Ashura and the togetherness and close and tight-knitness of the community and the caravan of Imam Hussein, and take some of that for ourselves, inshallah. It seems that because it's the end of times, or it seems that it is the end of times, Shaitan, one of the things that he targets is this actual very matter of togetherness. In other words, he likes to see us isolated. He likes to see us break off from the rest and just be on our own. This way, he can take care of us separately. So we have in our literature tons of it, actually, that points out that in Islam, what matters is the jama'ah, is the togetherness. I'm going to go through some examples, and some of them are pretty interesting, actually. Some of them we've heard before, some of them might be new to us. Number one, for example, all the emphasis on Salat al-Jama'ah, okay, something that we're used to and all of that. Of course, the Sunni school has done a little bit of a better job when it comes to this matter. Who are we kidding? And the fact that they make sure that they pray most of their prayers in jama'ah, of course they have more resources and all of that, so I'm not going to necessarily say it's our fault, but it seems sometimes we might be able to do better here. But why is it the case? Think about it. In our Shia sources, how much emphasis there is on Salat al-Jama'ah, and so the Ma'sumin, they'll explain that, okay, if there's this many people in the jama'ah, this much reward. This many people, this much reward. To the point where it reaches a certain number, it might be 10 even, if I'm not mistaken, that from there on, the imams are like, we can't even count. We can't even count the rewards that are going to be written for the ones who are taking part in this Salat al-Jama'ah. To the point that the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they say he would take attendance as if in his time, to see who's coming and who's not coming. Not to like call them out necessarily, but he knew that this culture is so instilled in the believers that when someone is not showing up to jama'ah, and this happens over a period of time, there must be something wrong. In other words, the default is what? Is jama'ah. To the point that I can tell something has happened, something must have happened, if a certain individual that I always see in the masjid is not showing up anymore. Yeah? You can tell something is wrong because they're not showing up. When 40 people recite dua, we have literature that says that dua is answered. So why do we get together in the nights of Qadr? Personally, I sometimes like to be on my own. But all in all, it's better to be in a group of brothers and sisters and individuals. We have literature for that. We have stories. Imam al-Sadiq says, my father, Imam al-Baqir, whenever he had a hajah, there's something that he needs from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What would he do? This is an imam now we're talking about. He can go in the corner of the home and do some dua to Allah, and inshallah Allah will fulfill that hajah that he has. But what would he do? It says that he would gather the family, no matter how many we were, 10, 15, 5, however many, and he'd do dua and tell us to say ameen. So okay, we're getting an idea here that there's something real about being together. Okay? Now some literature you might use the number 40. Other literature is saying no matter how many they were. Our scholars, they also mentioned that sometimes there's a person in a gathering, let's say in a gathering like this one, who really, really has that inkisar we talked about last night. And they're heartbroken. And they need something really from Allah. And they have reached a point where they are experiencing and feeling the fact that only Allah can take care of this. You know, it's like when you're in a ship, the Quran even gives this example. You're in a ship and the ship is sinking. Who do you turn to in that moment when there's no one else to help you? You turn to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That type of feeling that we have, that there's no one else that can help me but Allah. Sometimes, some of our scholars say this, there is a group of people that are doing dua. Everyone's like doing their normal dua. But there's one person there who is actually heartbroken. Because of this person's dua, all of a sudden everyone else's dua is answered as well. If the relationship here, in such a setting and gathering where one person's heart is broken, it affects everyone else. If this relationship and connection wasn't a real one between the believers, it doesn't make sense for one person's dua being accepted equaling everyone's dua being accepted. Yeah? If, for example, how does electrocution take place? How does it happen? Yeah? If wires aren't connected to each other, if you don't touch the wires, if there isn't an actual connection, electrocution never takes place. Oh, it's only when you actually touch the wire, an actual connection takes place, that electrocution takes place. If there's one live wire, it can affect anything that comes in contact with it. Why? Because of a real connection. Here also, if there wasn't, this is the point I'm trying to make, if there wasn't a real connection amongst the people, why should it be the case that one person's dua, because of them being heartbroken, affects everybody else? Something to think about.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Economic divide.
The Israeli economy has been in free fall for 9 months now. The impact of the genocidal war on the economy is not reported as much. Now, one reason is that Israel doesn't want the world to know how badly its economy is doing. Just a look at the major sectors, however, shows that it is doing pretty badly, like the manufacturing sector. When it comes to consumer spending, well, that's not as bad as it should be doing, since one sector of the Israeli society is being subsidized to spend money. Hi, I'm Kavita. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights coming up in today's program. We will be taking a look at Israeli businesses. They're suffering from severe revenue losses. One set of data suggests that 51% of businesses have reported 50% decline in revenues. Mainly small businesses have been hit hard. Then look at the Israeli army. Well, it's suffering on a variety of fronts. Budget restraints is one of them. There's a shortage of tanks and ammunition, and also a hidden war cost, or wounded regime forces, is one aspect of that. Then the economic recession that Israel may not say it's in, but it is in. Major sectors are flatlining. Sectors like tourism, agriculture, and construction impacted the most. And of course, that has led to business closures in the thousands.
The Israeli economic crisis continues to deepen. The closure of 40 to 46,000 businesses should ring alarm bells for Israeli officials. But it seems the regime officials are more content on focusing on the onslaught than on looking at the negative economic indicators that point to how the economy is tanking. Take the Yemeni army's drone attack that penetrated deep inside Tel Aviv and claimed the life of one, including 10, to have been injured. This sapped any investor confidence that was left. The Israeli stock market crashed the next day. In essence, Israel was facing a war scenario on a variety of fronts.
以色列军队这次对也门胡塞武装目标的攻击，在此之前，也门胡塞武装向以色列目标发动了上百次的攻击，但每一次都是美银联军对胡塞武装目标进行打击。以色列军队直接攻击也门胡塞武装的目标呢，自然而然会引发也门胡塞武装更直接或者更多的把以色列的目标列为他袭击的主要对象。
The tech sector, the heartbeat of Israel's economy, has been flatlining for quite some time now. 43.73% of Israeli startup companies were established outside of Israel in 2023, following the escalation of the onslaught in Gaza and its consequences on several fronts. This number of Israeli startup companies established outside of Israel is a significant jump compared to only 19.92% that were established outside of Israel in 2022. Technology companies suffer from four major risks due to the Gaza onslaught, the most important of which is the lack of employees and workers called by the army to serve in the reserve forces.
It's time now for our social media post. We've picked some interesting ones for you. First off, Israel's economy is falling apart from so many angles. BDS is wrecking them. You can have an impact. BDS for boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Israel lost 46,000 businesses and 25 billion construction project, 1.6 trillion in oil fund. As of this moment, 50% of Israeli startup companies are 6 months away from declaring bankruptcy. Israel economy is taking such a hefty loss by individual and organization level BDS campaigns. We're not even talking about the governments. While BDS is campaigning against genocide, the Zionists are campaigning against pens. They saw a Delta airline flight attendant wearing a pen just like this one, and they launched their own campaign because they were terrified. that were terrified too. These people should not fly. Hours after that tweet, a BDS campaign was launched and Delta apologized. That's the kind of power that you see when people are genuine about their solidarity and allies, not have AIPAC pumping money into their pockets. At any point that you feel helpless watching this genocide, just remember, this is not a pep talk. You do have the power to divest, sanction, boycott, and dismantle this genocidal apartheid state.
Next, Eilat Port in Israel has gone bankrupt. Intel has canceled a $25 billion investment. Turns out genocide is not good for the economy. Then, according to Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv, 46,000 Israeli businesses have been forced to shut down as a result of the ongoing war and its devastating effect on the economy, referring to Israel as a regime in collapse. Then, the end of Israel's economy. This was an attention grabber. Let's go to the website and see what the story is all about. And this is what the website has indicated in terms of what this has occurred, leading to what it said was the end of Israel's economy. Okay, let's bring in our guest for the first segment of our Q&A. Joining us first, we have Frank Wright. Frank Wright is a writer and geopolitical analyst. He writes about foreign affairs on his Substack website, which the address is frankwright.substack.com. Frank Wright, welcome to Economic Divide. We're looking at, first, the Israeli business closures, reportedly 40,000. It could be 46,000 since October the 7th. And also, it could reach 70,000 by some estimates by the end of 2024. That's a record number of business closures. With so many closures, what does that say about Israel's economic crisis? In other words, how bad is Israel's economy doing?
Well, one problem about understanding Israel, especially in the West, is that we tend to get only one side of it, and that's obviously transmitted from the Israeli government. So they're very reluctant to give you the bad news that Israelis themselves are fully aware of. One of the dimensions of the Israeli economic crisis, which is deepening, is that reports came in today through Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post of rising inflation that continues to rise without any hope of it coming down. In addition to this, obviously, at least 500,000 out of the entire Israeli population fled Israel following the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation. And of course, this is compounded by operations in the Red Sea and Turkey's economic blockade to combine to a kind of economic meltdown. Now, what are the Israelis doing about it? Who is the finance minister? That's Bezalel Smotrich, whose brief also includes being the Minister of Defense. And in a May article in Haaretz, he was described as a buffoon and a man who had presided over a budget of plunder. Why was it called a budget of plunder? Well, in a time of economic crisis for Israel, which it has, frankly, itself caused, Smotrich has been diverting money into, and I quote, ultra-Zionist groups, such as those of his own party, in order to basically finance Israel's further descent into chaos. The billions to religious Zionism that he's diverted obviously haven't helped. In this dimension, it's clear that Israel's becoming ever more dependent on things like the £3 billion promised to Israel by the new British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and ongoing US financial and military life support. But it's difficult to see how Israel comes out of this economic crisis. If we ignore all the other crises which caused Haaretz recently, I think in April, to say that Israel had faced a defeat, a total defeat. It's facing not just military defeat. It's also lost the media war. It's lost world opinion and is becoming rapidly a pariah state from which it's difficult to see it recovering. And combined with this is a deepening economic crisis as the region and the world unites against Israel for its horrific crimes in Gaza.
Thank you so much for that. Some important information there. Let's bring in our next guest, Lamprini Toma. She is a journalist and international correspondent for the main Greek independent media. The pressproject.gr is the address. Lamprini Toma, welcome to Economic Divide. The record number of Israeli businesses to be closed is actually not a record. During the COVID era, there were more Israeli businesses that closed. But after the onslaught, we're looking at around 40,000 with 70,000 by the end of 2024. And this really obviously is pointing to a dire economic situation. I'd like to get an idea from you how badly Israel's economy is doing and what prospects you see for this economy in the future.
Well, the war in Gaza is not only a genocide against the Palestinian people, it's also a murder of the Israeli economy. The Israeli economy has huge problems because of that genocide, because of what's happening. And it's not only because of the small businesses closing. Remember, it's small businesses. It's the common people that suffer there too. But also of the 70,000 or so people who moved from northern Israel, from the border with southern Lebanon, to hotels and have survived with money from the state until now. It's 10 months now. So it's a long period where Israel is being fed by the money of the United States. The implication of the United States is very important here too. And it's something that will destroy the life of those people. Of course, a lot of those people have two passports. We cannot forget that. And they can go back to the places where they came from, or if they have the money, they can come here. We have a lot of Israelis coming to Greece right now, lots and lots of them, especially people who do not like this war, from what they tell me, because they see it as unsafe to stay in their home country. So there's home country, okay, in Israel. There are two things. One thing is the economy. Second thing is the population feeling unsafe. And those are the main two hits that the resistance did to Israel.
All right, let me continue with that line of thought with our guest, Frank Wright. Frank Wright, taking a look at the business closures, the insecurity that Israelis are feeling, and then you have investors who are obviously not confident of their investments inside of Israel and are not pursuing any additional ones. What are we looking at when it comes to the interest that Israel has in terms of pursuing wars, like with Lebanon's Hezbollah? I mean, if that was to happen and to engulf the region, that would incur further economic damage to the Israeli regime. Has Israel considered that?
Well, I think when we say Israel, I think it's important to remember that there are significant voices against this policy and against Israel's decline. And there are voices not just from the Israeli public or from the hostage families, but also from former heads of Mossad and of government. And even the current head of the defense, Yoav Gallant, has openly criticized Netanyahu's policies to his face. So you really have to narrow this down to Netanyahu and his cabinet of Zionist extremists, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who prop up his government. Now, have they factored this in? I think Netanyahu banks on the intervention of the United States on his side in the event that he does conduct an operation in Lebanon. I think it's correct to assume that should Israel go into Lebanon in full force, then Iran will enter the war. I think this is a disaster for the region. I think this is well known. And has he factored that in? Yes. Regrettably, it appears that it is Netanyahu's strategy to cause this intervention of Iran and thereby, in his mind, trigger the direct involvement of the US in a military campaign. Of course, there are no shortage of lunatics in the United States who also press for that. But we must be careful to also note that there are plenty of sane American voices who see that this is a path to disaster. Not everyone is as deranged as the thanatotic homosexualist Lindsey Graham, who repeatedly calls for strikes on Iran, as well as many other neoconservatives.
Financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Studies are showing that although it has caused extensive destruction in the Gaza Strip, well, it has also caused damage to various sectors of the Israeli economy, which may continue until what's been predicted to be the year 2027. Let's take a look at some of those areas. First, what we took a look at here is the increasing budget deficit in Israel. Now, according to a report by this Hebrew language economic website, it's called Clocklist. In 2025, Israel is going to face a budget deficit of 5.2%. It's then going to go to 4.4% and then 3.7%. So it has increased up to 5.2%, and then you see it declining. In terms of the trade deficit itself, well, it has reached $2.5 billion, and that is a worrying sign. The figure may not sound like much, but when you go into a deficit, that's going to just keep accruing. The reason for this is the official and unofficial sanctions, in part, that countries have imposed on Israel, one of them being Turkey. Next, let's take a look at some of the industries which have been impacted. We chose the tourism industry. Why? Because the head of Israel's tourism department recently announced that this regime will end the year 2024 with just 1.2 million tourists. In the year 2023, that is, it is ended with 1.2 million tourists, and it expects the same for the year 2024, the same number, that is, that came in the year 2004, okay? So the year 2023 to have ended with 1.2 million tourists, the same projection, if not less, for the year 2024. Those are the same numbers as the year 2004. And this is only going to get worse. Why? Because you have this new front that's happening in the north with Hezbollah, potentially with Lebanon, to have a full-fledged war going on there, even though their military exchanges have been going on a daily basis. Then we move on to the next set of data that we have. And this is before the Gaza onslaught. We'd like to take a look at the number of workers, 30,000, number of foreign workers that were in the occupied lands. And then what happened after the October 7 Operation Al-Aqsa flood happened, many of them, by the way, who were from Thailand, well, that number decreased, 8,000, from 30,000 to 8,000. In terms of the breakdown, there was a worker stoppage, as I mentioned, from October 7th. The breakdown, workers from Thailand to be 10,000, Palestinians to be 12,000. The number 30,000 up there is an approximate. I know that this doesn't add up, but that's what the source told us in terms of the total number of workers and then the breakdown. Of course, you have Palestinian workers who have been barred from working in the West Bank, and that has obviously led to many shortages in industries like the agricultural sector, to be one of them, facing a shortage of about is to be 20,000 workers, and that's a lot. The direct effect of this problem was in the reduction of basically agricultural products, and also in the increase in the price of fruits and vegetables. Well, now we can talk about what that has created in terms of the agricultural products being impacted by the shortage of labor, high price of food. That's a problem now. It has, in some respects, created not only food insecurity, but also poverty. You have a company that actually does this. The report of the Israel Food Security Council has pointed out that this regime actually has no policy to deal with and fight the problems of food insecurity and hunger. In this regard, social policy of the Zionist regime ignores the immediate needs of hundreds of thousands of families. That's right, that's how much there are. The National Food Security Project, under the supervision of the Ministry of Welfare, it can only respond to 26,000 families that you see. That's about 10% of the needy population. And, of course, household expenses on top of that have increased 62%, which falls under the umbrella of things like food insecurity contributing to poverty. I know it's a lot of data there, but it just shows the dire situation in some respects. I'm going to bring back our guest to break it down for us. Let's see what Frank Wright has to say, writer and geopolitical analyst who writes about foreign affairs on his website Substack. Frank Wright, welcome back. We're looking at the fact that the Israeli regime is risking actually its existence to reach a goal that it says it wants to eliminate these fighters, Hamas fighters, and so forth and so on. And it's taken Israel down its path, and it has alienated itself to the entire world. Do you think that that risk is worth it, what Israel is doing, decimating its economy in the long term?
When we speak of Israel's path towards self-destruction, it's once again extremely important to consult the Israeli news sources to see what the Israelis themselves think about it. Now, repeatedly, former heads of government, former heads of Mossad, and former generals and major generals in the Israeli army itself have all said that Netanyahu is leading Israel into the abyss, onto a path of self-destruction. Why would he do this? It's also important to remember that if Netanyahu moves anywhere towards peace, if he moves towards a hostage deal, if he moves to negotiate an end to hostilities, if he de-escalates in any way, his government will be dissolved. because Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich have repeatedly stressed that they will dissolve his coalition if he does any such thing. If he moves towards peace, he's finished. And a move towards peace means that Netanyahu certainly faces criminal charges on leaving office. If Netanyahu leaves office, therefore, he's ruined. All he can do is escalate. Aside from that, it is very important to remember what Netanyahu has been dedicated to for his entire political career. It was Netanyahu who first charged in 1990 that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. It was Netanyahu who exhorted the US Congress on September the 12th, 2002, to attack Iraq as he said, the best choice, the first choice, in a series of preemptive strikes that included Libya and Iran. And he's constantly sought to destroy the peace process. He's on record of saying this. He's on record of repeatedly saying that if you want to destroy the two-state solution, you must support me and you must support Hamas. It is Netanyahu who has guaranteed that Hamas is the only power in Gaza in order to isolate it and therefore justify the attacks that all the Israelis and even Politico has agreed that Netanyahu knew in advance that these attacks were going to take place. That is no longer a question of speculation. Did he know that those attacks were coming? Yes. Does it serve his agenda? Yes. What is his agenda? His agenda is a strategy of escalation because he has spent his entire political career in destroying any possibility of a two-state solution.
All right, interesting thoughts that he presented there, I guess, Frank Wright. Let's see what Lamprini Toma thinks, journalist and international correspondent of the main Greek independent media, thepressproject.gr. Welcome back to the program, Lamprini. We're looking at what I like to continue this train of thought of how Israel is leading itself to a path of self-destruction through Netanyahu to continue what it is doing, this genocidal war, and also his interest to open up other war fronts. But it's decimating its economy. Why do you think Netanyahu is doing that?
Well, it alienated itself from the countries that are sufficiently or at least in the middle of accepting what we call international law. The countries that ignore international law and see themselves as the leaders of the world or the ones that would have to decide for the rest of us, those countries are with Israel. We see that every day. And that's why the genocide still exists. Israel cannot continue like that. That's for sure. It has lost a lot, mostly, even if today they stop the war, they have lost the moral ground of what happened before, of what happened with the Holocaust, of what they had to suffer, the Jewish people. It has lost the right to say that it represents all of the Jewish people, because we know that thousands of Jewish people in the rest of the world are against this genocide, are against the Zionist politics in Israel. And it also has lost the right to say that it's a democracy. We know it's not a democracy. It's obvious it's not a democracy anymore. Everything happens because this person, Bibi Netanyahu, is trying to survive in a very difficult political landscape for him, and he takes Israel down with him, because a lot of people, especially of the far right, like him and far right, are collaborating in destroying their own country, really, in destroying everything that they try to build through the diplomacy and power and force in decades.
Israeli businesses' revenue losses are very dramatic. 51% of businesses have had a 50% decline in revenues, with small businesses to have been hit the hardest. This has impacted the economic chain from suppliers all the way down to the factories and the supply chain. Meanwhile, the Israeli army itself is facing challenges that it had not foreseen before. Aside from budget restraints, there's a shortage of tanks and ammunition due to the damage that the resistance forces have inflicted. This puts into question how the IOF can continue its onslaught while fighting on multiple fronts. Additionally, there is also a shortage of regime forces. Conscription notices for ultra-Orthodox men have been sent,
with 3,000 potential Haredi conscripts to have received draft orders in the coming weeks. Also, a petition demanding the inclusion of female regime forces in the Army's armed corps has been submitted. Many Israeli analysts are of the belief that Netanyahu is continuing these wars in order to save himself from prison due to corruption charges that he faces. And this has brought intense criticism against him.
Netanyahu seemed to be failing his policies that led up to October 7th in the failure on the day itself, on the inability to achieve the objectives ever since and to unify the country and somehow provide the comfort and support the Israeli society needs now, playing divisive politics, playing for political survival. That's not what the Israeli public wants now. So there is a yearning for a new leadership, but that's a process that takes time because we are in a time of war and many people in the public are kind of skeptic whether that's the right moment to go to the streets and make a big fuss about.
The Yemeni army has penetrated deep inside occupied Palestine and has hit Tel Aviv. How is that for investor confidence? With the possibility of another war with Yemen's army, chances of Israel's economy to begin recuperating is close to none. It's out of the question. The stock market actually crashed after that incident. Israel should know that it should be thinking now of how to save its economy from tanking instead of how it's going to bounce back. Never mind proceeding to get engaged in other wars. Maybe they are and they don't care. Those are my final thoughts for this edition of Economic Divide. Thank you so much for being with us. From Ikava Tawi and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أعظم الله أجورنا وأجوركم بمصابنا بالحسين عليه السلام. Welcome brothers and sisters, this is Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept all your mornings and deeds during the month of Muharram, the month of Azar. Here we are with another episode, and in this studio we have dear brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And dear brother Sheikh Ahmad. Assalamu alaikum dear brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
Today we want to talk about the different aspect of Imam Hussein's uprising and his movement. Here, I would like to start the talk. Brother, we have read in the history of the world, especially in World War II, when Japanese pilot did so many suicide attacks against Allied warship. Later, we had Palestinian suicide bombers during the Second Intifada, which shocked the Western Cultural Front, and then 9/11 happened. So these were the incidents when the contemporary world got to know the concept of martyrdom and shahada. With this introduction, I want you to tell us about the meaning of shahada, martyrdom in Islam and Shia. What is this shahada, this martyrdom? And why is it this concept of shahada is so tangled and associated with the Shi'i world? Brother Ali, can you distinguish between promoting violence and hatred in a society and being a revolutionary kind of fan? Because some people say if you act against certain beliefs in a society, or let's say Islamic Ummah, in order to change some sort of values, you are actually weakening the pillar of that society. And it is not okay to do that. So what are the aims of promoting this being revolutionary in your idea?
Well, I think before answering this question, we need to know about what is violence. So violence means something that, I mean, a very harsh and a very severe action in front of any social or intellectual or social or personal action or reaction. I mean, there's reactions that are usually very harsh, mm-hmm. are not coming from a sacred base. I mean, are not stemmed from something which is really profound and valuable. For example, in the realm of politics, if I do not agree with your viewpoints in the politics or in your political viewpoints, mm-hmm. so I come very harshly towards you and severely, I mean, stand in front of your beliefs just because I believe something else. I mean, this is something that, for example, violence means in the world of politics. But how can we compare it to the sacred concept of Shahada or martyrdom? Because martyrdom is usually a term that is being used for a person who sacrifices his life on the way of God, sometimes even just to defend his own land and geographical borders, mm-hmm. though it is very precious. But for the martyrdom, it is even something beyond that. I mean, you are defending the borders of culture, borders of your religion, borders of loyalty, borders of all the good actions and all the moralities. Mm-hmm. So this is more valuable than actually defending the physical and geographical borders. So a person who sacrifices his own life, his own soul for a whole society, the whole community. So it differs with a person who just is going to defend his political, stances, whether they are right or wrong. I mean, to prove that they are wrong or right, I mean, it takes even a long time. But we want to say a person who puts his life on his hands and delivers it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, why? For the sake of God, to defend others, to actually serve other humankind. So what action better than helping and serving the humankind is on the earth? Based on some narrations, if we dive into religious sources, we see as if the Holy Prophet and the Imams, succeeding Imams after him, found nothing more precious than serving the humankind. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is very precious. So for the sake of these people, to defend them, to defend their lives, since their lives are precious and they are, whether they are believers or unbelievers. So you are, I mean, giving whatever you have.
Yeah.
For what they need to have. So this concept is very precious if you want to compare it to these two. So in the concept of martyrdom that we are talking about, this cannot be compared to violence because for example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life. What for? He came with an invitation of the people to Kufa, to guide them to actually take their leadership of, I mean, religious leadership, and even the leadership of Islamic Ummah. But when he found no other way, he even insisted, I'm ready even to go back.
Yeah.
I mean, he told them that I'm ready to go back. But they did not accept, and they asked him either to pay allegiance with the caliph or with the caliph of the time or the ruler of the time or the governor of the time. Or get killed.
Yeah.
So he did not accept that humiliation. So he stood and sacrificed his life for this sacred cause. Mm-hmm. We want to say that these two concepts cannot be compared. I mean, in our eyes, we might say, okay, this is also a sort of violence. No, he this kind of look to the life and to the existence is not a violent kind of look. This is the most merciful kind of look to the existence and life. Since you find your life, your whole existence, nothing in comparison to the freedom of others. Yeah. So you sacrifice it.
Thank you. Thank you, dear brother. Sheikh, I had a friend who kept saying Imam Hussein alayhi salam was trying to maintain the peace even more than that, more than Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And I was like, what are you saying? Then he presented some facts and about his claim. Facts like, Imam Hussein alayhi salam didn't want Yazid's agents to shed his blood, holy blood, in Mecca, so he left the city. Or another fact he presented was Imam Hussein alayhi salam tried to negotiate with Umar ibn Sa'd and other high-ranked like general in Yazid's army. If this narrative is true, then why so many scholars support the revolutionary narrative of Karbala? Do you think Imam Hussein alayhi salam didn't want to keep the peace within the Muslim Ummah at the time?
Of course, we can say that he tried his best, that his life and his blood was not shed, because the basic purpose of an imam is to serve the community, to guide the community, and to be the leader of the community. So the first role of an imam, alayhi salatu wassalam, was to guide the Muslim community. And so, as Brother Ali has also said, that this is the last option that we are trying for. So martyrdom is a choice that one accepts wholeheartedly once realizing that no other option is left. So your friend is correct in saying that Imam Hussain alayhi salam tried his level best not to shed his blood or not to lay down his life without conveying the message of Islam to the Yazidi soldiers. But once he realized that this was not possible, he was wholeheartedly accepted the mission of